And our preaching text this day is found in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verses 12 to 18. And you'll find this on page 553 of your pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 1, 12 to 18. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. And what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. In the late 60s, when I was in college, that's the 1960s, not the 1860s. But at that time, I took it upon myself to answer the four great questions of life. And I decided to do it without the church as well, without God. So I thought, I asked, is there a God? From whence did I come? To whither do I go? And what is the meaning of it all? And of course, as sophomores are fond of doing, I did this with great affectation and pretension too. As if no one had ever done this before, and I was launching out under the sea of philosophy for the first time. I grew my hair long. I sat around in dark coffee houses, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee, and looked morose and despairing. We listened to folk singers like Pete Seeger and Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. It was also important to read the correct authors, too. So I read men like Albert Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre, and most importantly, Franz Kafka. The grunge have nothing on us hippies of the 60s, no. The grunge rockers, no. Franz Kafka was a Czech-born Jew from the ghetto in Prague. He lived from 1883 to 1924. He had all the credentials for a proper existentialist. He grew up under an abusive father in a time and place where Jews were hated and persecuted. And his own mind and emotional state, just natively, were filled with depression and sorrow and hopelessness. So he was a perfect candidate for the ideal existentialist author. And he was a gifted writer. But he even viewed this not as a gift, but a curse. About his own gift of writing, he said, "Writing is a deeper sleep than death. Just as one wouldn't pull a corpse from its grave, I can't be dragged from my desk at night." See, that sounds perfect in a dark coffee house, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. His works expressed quite articulately the sense of despair and meaninglessness current in the Beat generation of the 50s and 60s. And they, of course, the Beat generation, those of you that know your cultural history, and that morphed later into the hippies of the 60s and 70s. One of my favorites was his short story, The Metamorphosis, that beautifully encapsulated the meaningless and random absurdity of life. The opening sentence of that story is, "As Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from uneasy dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a giant insect." And it goes downhill from there. And what struck me in that day was an anthology of existentialist writers that I bought in a used bookstore that included Kafka, Camus, Sartre, Nietzsche, and guess who? Guess who else was in there? Koheleth. This book, Ecclesiastes, was in that anthology of existentialist writings. Seemed that as hard as I tried, I could not get away from the scriptures and from God. Now, for some lighter contrast, the other week I was watching a favorite diversion of mine, pro football. It was the Eagles-Falcons Sunday night game, and who should run out on the field to quarterback the Eagles for the Eagles injured Michael Vick, but Mike Kafka. Mike Kafka. That name is not that familiar, is it? Not that current. Was he any relation to Franz Kafka? It didn't matter. For me, this great wheel of philosophy had come full cycle. The meaningless despair of existential philosophy had now come to the meaningless despair of the Philadelphia Eagles trying to win another Super Bowl. At both ends of this despair, there was a Kafka. One a serious philosopher and author, and the other an entertainer and football player. Kafka's. As we consider Solomon and his little book of vapor under the sun, that is the book of Ecclesiastes, we too will come full cycle from things like Franz Kafka's serious philosophy. Solomon will treat all of this in the course of his book. Philosophy, hard work, great wealth, all the way to Mike Kafka's frivolous entertainment. He will study, if you will, frivolous entertainment as well. In other words, from one Kafka to another. Therefore, I find this book to be, for me, a tale of two Kafkas. So let us take upon ourselves today a little bit of that sense of Kafkaesque. Does anybody remember that adjective, adverb from the 60s and 70s? It's kind of faded from use now, but it used to be an oft-employed adjective or adverb to describe something absurd or meaningless or random. Let us look at then this Kafkaesque sense of the absurd and despair as we look at what Solomon hints at, what it might be under the sun, shall we? Let's look to our text today. 2 points I want to make with you in the course of our study today, taken from our text. You have on the inside flap of your bulletin just a brief outline with those points. Number one, wind. He will incorporate for us another image of fleetingness, of transience, of that which lasts for but a moment, and that is wind. It is also inscrutable. Wind. Those of sincere heart and godly wisdom will find, in the end, that all that is done under heaven is inscrutable and incomplete. All that is done under heaven is inscrutable and incomplete. Satisfying? Satisfying for you? Perhaps not. That's good. We discern that this is indeed Solomon in this book as we look at our text. Look at verse 12 in particular. I, the preacher, Ecclesiasticus, from which we derive the Latin term, of course, from which we derive the name of this book, Ecclesiastes. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. There's a lot of dispute as you read the background to this book. You find there's a lot of dispute as to who exactly, precisely who wrote this. Some say Solomon, some say the book is much later. One of the other kings or some pseudonymous writer appropriated the name of Solomon and the persona of Solomon so that he could have his authority as well. But we believe, of course, that this indeed was Solomon. Our text indicates that as well. Ask yourself this very question. How many kings ruled Israel from Jerusalem? Huh? How many kings actually ruled Israel? That's the term he uses, from Jerusalem. Keep in mind, as you answer this, that Israel per se was only ruled by two kings, wasn't it? From Jerusalem. That is David and Solomon. what happened after the death of Solomon. If you know your Bible history, you know, of course, that the kingdom split. Israel was not ruled from Jerusalem, was it? Rehoboam and those after him ruled in Jerusalem over Judah, while Jeroboam and those after him ruled Israel from Shechem in Ephraim. So, there were only two kings who ruled over Israel proper from Jerusalem, David and his son Solomon. Our author declares, in fact, that he acquired wisdom surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. That is, David and Saul and all the wise men who could be counted there, men like Ahithophel and others. Therefore, the only candidate who could here be considered is Solomon. It is he who composed this book. And as the wisest man who ever lived, he then begins the quest that your humble servant so arrogantly set out upon back in the 60s. Only Solomon lived in the 10th century B.C., and he was a bit more gifted on the wisdom scale than me. Our text declares that Solomon applied his heart. I applied my heart, he says. I applied my heart. Now, the strength and power of that verb does not come through in the English very well, the idea of application. This is not the rock and roll sentiment gushed out on the red carpet runway in Beverly Hills, no. Rather, this is tenacity. This is the tenacity of a Lance Armstrong, perhaps, winning the Tour de France after battling cancer. This is the dedication and commitment of an Olympian champion like Michael Phelps, getting up at 4 a.m. every morning to swim laps and train, eventually breaking Mark Spitz's record of 7 gold medals by accumulating 8 himself. Phelps did, didn't he, in 2008 in Beijing? That's the sense in which Koheleth dedicates himself, commits himself, to seek and to search out all that is done under heaven. Once again, a new phrase for us, right? Under heaven. It's synonymous with under the sun. Note the repetitive emphasis through our text today, too. I applied my heart in verse 13. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, he says in verse 17. There's that sense of constant dedication, commitment, recommitment. A bulldog, if you will, a pit bull, never letting go. So, true to Proverbs as well. True to Proverbs. This is exactly the kind of commitment with which one is to seek wisdom. Remember, we've said all along that you must, as you read this book, you must keep your finger in Proverbs because you have to keep going back to it. He alludes to it. He expects you to have a familiarity with the wisdom literature, not only Proverbs, but also Song of Solomon and Job and the Psalms. The Proverbs are replete with the exhortation. Son, son, listen to my words. Seek wisdom. Seek wisdom first. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. For the gain from her is better than gain from silver, and her profit is better than gold. And he means that, too, as we will see, as he explores riches and wealth, too. So these verses before us today are Solomon's declaration of intent as we're beginning. We're just beginning this book, aren't we? Just beginning to open it up. And these verses before us today are his declaration of intent, whereby he generally declares what he's about during his reign. David being a man of war, quelling Israel's enemies all around, allowing Solomon now the space to pursue life via wisdom in the manner that he outlines here. So, from here on out, now, he will explore the particular things done under the sun. This is a universal book. All men can resonate with this book because the experience that he plumbs to its depths with wisdom is indeed the universal experience of man. He will work and think. He will spoil himself with pleasure and sexual gratification, and he'll ponder that. He will build lavish monuments in stone that men trust will endure long after they're gone. And Koheleth will consider that. He will rule as a vaunted king with a worldwide reputation for wisdom. And he'll bluntly tell us what that is worth. And he will be so awash in wealth that it becomes a proverb in Israel, silver was as plentiful as stones, cedar as common as the sycamore of the Shephelah. And he'll give us his own bottom line on that too. But for now, in our text today, he's content with generalities. What's his bottom line? He says, it was a blast. I had a rollicking good time as the big cheese of Israel. No, hardly, is it? It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. That's what he finds at the end of the day. That word God, too, is that he uses throughout the book, he doesn't use the personal name, the covenant name of Israel, Yahweh. He uses the other word, Elohim, which was current throughout the Middle East as well. It would resonate with other cultures, other men. This is once again a sign of its universal character and nature. It is meant to be preached to all men. Us, too. But there's an uncomfortable truth here expressed that will ring like a bell throughout this tale of two Kafkas. And that is, God gives a bunch of stuff, and not all of it pleasant. He's not a grandpa in the sky with his candy machine. No, he gives a bunch of stuff, but not all of it pleasant. God gives this unhappy business we call life. As we saw last week with the burdensome toil under the sun, remember? We see a direct allusion to the curse, both here and there. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. And on the curse goes, right? Sweat of your brow you will eat until you finally return to dust yourself. Unlike the pagan cosmologies, this is no cosmic accident, no evolutionary happenstance that we find ourselves in death and misery, and that we find ourselves the fruitlessness, futility of life that comes through so often. It is no random tragedy about which God can do nothing. No, rather, he caused it. He planned it. In fact, the text tells us he gave it, right? Natan, the Hebrew word for give. He gave it to us this way. There's no getting around it. This is a theme that will ring like a bell throughout Ecclesiastes, and it comports precisely with my definition of the curse, and that is that unchangeable set of circumstances of sin and misery above which no man can rise by his own power. That unchangeable set of circumstances of sin and misery above which no man can rise by his own power. The world does not know this. The world is, we keep trying, every generation, don't we, by our own power to rise above the curse? God keeps slapping us down, too. So, Solomon does not polish the curse for us. He gives it to us unvarnished. Behind all of the brevity of things done under heaven, remember we are translating the Hebrew word for vapor, literally as vapor, not vanity or meaninglessness as you have in some of your translations, but as vapor, something that is here and gone so quickly. Behind all of the brevity of things done under heaven, the frustration and the futility, the folly and the emptiness, lies the supreme folly of our first father, Adam. He aspired to the blessings of eternal Eden by his own power, didn't he? All of the things that Solomon will aspire to, reach for, grasp after, some of which he will attain in fullness of measure more than any other man. All of these things, Adam aspired to the blessings of eternal Eden by his own power, and God frustrated it. He cursed it. And since then, we were prized constantly, every generation, the precise thing for which Adam aspired. That is, Eden on our own, don't we? Eden on our own. And Koheleth will labor by all appearances as Adam did. He'll do all of the things that Adam was created for and aspired to do, tried to do, even as every man tries to do himself, right? With this exception, he will do so by wisdom. He will do so by wisdom. He will check that tendency we all have to get Eden on our own. There's a great irony at work in this book, because though he is living like every other man, even as we do, right? We share the world with our co-creators, co-creations, other men and women, don't we? But we hopefully do not do that as folly and in foolishness. We have wisdom as we do this. Solomon will not sink into meaningless or vanity or despair completely and ultimately, and neither should you, dear listener. We share the same planet, the same country, the same neighborhood as our lost brothers in Adam. The same sun shines on us all. The same rain falls on our heads. The same joys and pleasures, sorrows and tragedies come to us all, don't they? It is this atmosphere that Koheleth cultivates here throughout our text. And we are to resonate with them and they with us in these things under the sun. That's why this is a very evangelistic book, I might tell you. This preaches evangelistically, and you are meant to incorporate it into your outreach to your lost friends and neighbors and relatives. Because wisdom will speak directly to the universal impulse to grab Eden on our own. And we'll hint at what wisdom finds behind that first fleshly impulse. The first fleshly impulse is to reach for Eden, achieve it on our own. But he is hinting at what lurks behind that first impulse too, all through this book. What does Koheleth say to that impulse for Eden on our own? He says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vapor and a striving after wind. Vapor and a striving after wind. Here and gone. So elusive. Who can catch the wind? Huh? Poof. Poof and it's gone. All our vaunted aspirations. Poof, Mr. President. Poof. Your lasting legacy evaporates before the dust is brushed off the tribute carved on your marble mausoleum. For what it's worth, Mr. Roosevelt, Social Security, for example, your lasting legacy will soon be thrown on the scrap heap of socialist history, a monumental failure. For what it's worth, Mr. Eisenhower, the great interstate highway system you built, your lasting legacy will crumble into dust as soon as we can build a high-speed rail. No one will ride it, but we'll build those high-speed rails. And for what it's worth, Mr. Obama, the monstrosity of universal health care, your supposed lasting legacy, will be aborted as soon as we can elect representatives of the people with enough spine to reverse it. I tried to think of Bill Clinton's lasting legacy, but I couldn't think of anything. So, well, if this is true of presidents, what of peons like us? Huh? Poof. In the grand scheme of things, that's another way of putting under the sun. In the grand scheme of things, all that is done by everyone is vaporous. Steam rising. Smoke spiraling, a breath on a winter morning. This is the burden of the curse. This is its reality, how it is played out, if you will, on the grand stage of life. With this, we can resonate with lost men and women, can we not? You and I know this truth. We know this reality. It is the curse that has undone all. We know because we have a revelation that's not natural, a supernatural revelation, do we not? That tells us these things. But from the perspective of our fellow man with whom we dwell under the sun, this cannot be fathomed. It can't be discerned by unspiritual men, can it? Only by those born of the Spirit. They're spiritually discerned, these things. The natural man cannot find it out. To him, as soon as he begins to grasp and understand it, poof, it evaporates. As soon as he begins to penetrate to the bottom of a question, whoosh, it's gone like the wind. That's the sense of striving after wind. So it will seem to you as well, O fool, if you employ only the wisdom and knowledge that exists under the sun. Jesus wisely employs this very sense of the wind, does he not? Back in John chapter 3, if you turn over there for just a moment, John chapter 3. With that in mind, read these verses again. How do lost men scratch their heads at Christians, don't they? What is it with you guys? Well, come to life in Christ and you will find out. Your eyes will be open, your ears unstopped. You will come alive in a realm to which you're dead right now. Christ bids us to that. He says, do not marvel that I said to you, you must be born again. The wind blows where it wishes. You hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. Mr. Lost Man, you're chasing after wind if you think that by any other thing than the new birth, you know what I'm talking about. Solomon is saying the same thing here. From all that we can gather, from the evidence presented to us under heaven, under the sun, those things before us, lost men end up in this predicament all the time, don't they? That proverb is true before us. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Now, let me remind you that Koheleth worked very hard over these little ditties, these proverbial sayings. He says in chapter 12, for instance, that he was weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. And we should do the same in interpreting them. That's the thing. Sweat. There is sweat equity in this book. You will get out far more than you put in, but you must sweat to do it. Now, the Old Testament notion of the crooked is that which is obscure and hidden and concealed. The Old Testament Hebrew notion of the straight is that which is clear, open, and revealed. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God, Isaiah says. That means clear and evident and traversable. Did you ever go hiking in the backwoods and lose the trail? That sinking feeling in your stomach, where's the trail? Well, Mark and Stuart and I, we lost the trail for a little while, just hiking in a perfectly known place, and still that little twitch in the stomach. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. That is, make it clear and evident and traversable. The righteous are straight. It becomes a metaphor then. The righteous are straight. That is, they're open, they're genuine, they're honest. We have a phrase that says, what you see is what you get. And that should be how every Christian lives. The righteousness of the blameless keeps his way straight, the psalmist says. The wicked are crooked. That is, they have hidden motives. They're not what they seem. They're disingenuous. That's the sense of crooked. Put away from you crooked speech, the Proverbs say, and put devious talk far from you. See the equivalency there between devious and crooked? Men whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways, the Proverbs say. And so it is with knowing and understanding, as it is here in this context. What Koheleth is saying here is that God is crooked. He says so in Proverbs, in Psalm 18, 25 and 26, for example. God is crooked. He is not a crook, but he is behaving crookedly. That is, he is obscuring. He is making unclear what is clear to others. Psalm 18. Turn over to Psalm 18 for just a moment. We have just a classic understanding of a crooked God. Psalm 18, 25 and 26. With the merciful you show yourself merciful, with the blameless man you show yourself blameless, and with the purified you show yourself pure, and with the crooked you make yourself seem tortuous. Now in the Hebrew those are identical words. So we could just as easily translate this, and with the crooked you make yourself seem crooked, or with the crooked you make yourself crooked. That doesn't mean he's wicked or evil or a crook. I am not a crook. He is not saying that. But indeed, he is being obscure. He is being, as we say in our outline, inscrutable. That is what our text puts before us today about God. God hides this general truth from the natural man. Natural man cannot plumb its depth. He cannot find it out in general revelation, as we would put it theologically. He cannot find the ultimate truth. He cannot find salvation, redemption, ultimate, eternal, lasting answers under the sun, because God himself has intentionally hid it. God is not standing in heaven saying, boy, I wish my all those creatures, I wish they could just find it out. If only there was something I could do. No. He is intentionally hiding. It is the glory of God to hide a thing, the Proverbs say. It is the glory of a king to find those things out. God hides this general truth from the natural man. He intentionally makes his world and his ways utterly inscrutable, as we say in the outline. Utterly inscrutable. The Oxford English Dictionary defines inscrutable as wholly mysterious, impenetrable. So, without the aid of a word spoken from above the sun, that's constantly hinted at. Every time he uses that phrase, under the sun, you should be thinking, oh yeah, well, we also know we're screaming in our minds, aren't we, to say, there's something above the sun. There's something above the sun too. A word from God, isn't there? Yes, there is. So without that aid of a word spoken from above the sun, from heaven, by God, we would know nothing of this, would we? We would be right there with the rest of lost mankind. The natural man has never, in the past, he cannot now, nor will he ever penetrate to the bottom of things. He will never lay on to eternal, lasting, abiding truth by his own natural wisdom. It will always prove to be as enduring as a vapor, as fruitful as chasing after a breeze. And our Proverbs companion phrase echoes the same truth. What is lacking cannot be counted. Isn't that a great turn of phrase? You can see he labored over this one a while. What is lacking cannot be counted. You can't spend money that you don't have. Although our federal government seems to have found a way of doing that, didn't they? But you can't. You can't spend money. Ultimately, and I'll try not to download all of this, but you can't spend money that you don't have. You will pay for it in one way or another one day, right? You can't count numbers that aren't there. We have a saying in philosophy, you can't prove a negative. The atheist, I was a fool. In those days, the atheist is a fool precisely because there's no way you can prove that there is no God. You can't prove a negative. And so it is, the fool cannot arrive at ultimate, lasting, enduring truth for which there's no evidence. God is hiding it. God has purposely made it insufficient for him. It is incomplete, as we say in our outline. Isn't that cheerful? Isn't that ebullient? Doesn't that make you happy? No. I don't want anybody to come up and say, Pastor, that was that made me feel good. If it is, then maybe we need some counseling. Because it's not meant to make us feel good. This is not a feel-good book, a feel-good message. It is this that Koheleth laments, too, doesn't he? He laments. And what lost man who thinks, doesn't lament, too, and know this? So what is the net effect on the lost man? Verses 16 to 18, wind. Those of sincere heart and godly wisdom will find in the end that the world's inscrutability and incompleteness is grievous. They will find that it is grievous. In verses 16 to 18, Koheleth gives us a summary statement of his relative success in his aspirations. He got what he was after. First Kings, and once again, have your finger, one finger in Proverbs, the other in First Kings, because he expects you to resource that to know what his life was like, the precy of his life in First Kings 1 to 11, and have the law at your elbow too. For that matter, as well as the rest of the wisdom literature, he expects you to bring that to the table when you're reading his book. He got what he was after. First Kings details his quest for and his obtainment of wisdom. He asked God, "Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people." Boy, don't you wish our present rulers prayed that prayer too? Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to govern this your great people, he asked. And God was pleased. Text tells us that God was pleased that Solomon asked for this. And it's, therefore he gave it abundantly, such that we must take him at his word that no one before or since possessed this gift in the abundance that Solomon did. No one, whoever came upon it in the stage of history, ever had this wisdom to the degree of Solomon? Except one, maybe, huh? Yeah. And that we are to look for and to look to as well. God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, the text tells us, and breadth of mind, like the sand on the seashore. And his fame was in all the nations. Can you begin to see why many thought, too, that this was the promised Redeemer? There is indeed Christ in every book of the Bible, isn't there? You can begin to see why many thought that this was the promised Redeemer who would fulfill the Davidic covenant. God promised to David in that covenant, "I will raise up your offspring after you, and I will establish his kingdom. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." The early salad days of Solomon, this was the guy. Note that he also pursued, Solomon did, the knowledge of madness and folly. That is, he decided to go into politics and work for the government and solve the world's problems. Sorry, I can't resist. And I'm only being partially facetious, too. The knowledge of madness and folly is not quite the same thing as being a mad fool. Perhaps he did not set out to become a mad fool, but only seeking to understand it, you know, and its tragic pitfalls, perhaps. But Solomon walked that tightrope and fell off, didn't he? In the end, he fell prey to what I call the Chicago way. I lived in Chicago for 13 years. Solomon fell prey to the Chicago way. He loved many foreign women, the text tells us. He had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, stables full of horses. His weakness is what I saw living close to Arlington Park, where they raced horses, beautiful facility. Women and horses. Women and horses were Solomon's downfall. And there's a lot that surrounds Arlington Park, too. Gambling, booze, money, prostitutes. And like our first parents, who saw that the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. She did what? Eve did what? She took it, she ate, didn't she? So did Solomon. He saw that the women and the horses were good for fun, a delight to the eyes and the senses, and that he would know madness and folly to the full by indulging himself. Just makes sense, doesn't it? But what is his conclusion at the end of the day? I perceive that this also is a striving after wind, as every lost son of man finds in the end when he pursues these things too. Many broken men at Arlington Park in Chicago. The Chicago Way. He found it. Thus many of the Proverbs are the voice of bitter experience. He who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself, Solomon says. That sounds like the voice of experience, doesn't it? The Lord's delight is not in the strength of a horse, nor his pleasure in the legs of a man, but the Lord takes pleasure in those who fear him. Indeed, the sorrow and the grief that accompany true wisdom, whether gained by example or experience, in fact, we might even define wisdom as knowledge gained by observation of other people's example, and folly as that knowledge gained by experience. If you have to gain all your knowledge by experience, you're a fool. This sorrow and grief that accompanies wisdom is indeed common to those who gain it, isn't it? Just very simply, on a level we can all understand, what parent doesn't watch with grief a son go out on his own to experiment with drugs and rock and roll, for example? Even a little bit of common sense tells them that this path will only end in sorrow, pain, and death. So it is with friends and workmates, anyone that we love who plays the fool in this fashion. The pain and the grief of wisdom as watching so many of those you love live like fools and suffer too as a consequence, right? This too then is vapor, isn't it? Vapor. The wisdom that we gain in life passes, goes up in smoke, if you will. And so it is the wisest one who ever lived grieved as well, too. Remember we read from Isaiah 53 today? He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Much of that grief being precisely what we've been talking about here today. Looking out upon his creatures, looking upon those he loves. That grief precisely because of the foolishness of those creatures that he loved. When he saw the crowds, Matthew tells us he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Well, what is it that Good Shepherd then did in his grief and his sorrow? Isaiah 53 tells us, doesn't it? Let's turn over there just in closing as we ponder the wisest one who ever did live. Isaiah 53, verses 4 to 6. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. This man of sorrow and grief. He knows your sorrow. He knows your grief. He knows the vaporousness of life. He knows as we age, as we come to the end of our days, we feel to our bones, to our soul, the vaporous nature, not only of our souls, but of life itself. He knows this. You know this now too. You know that there is not only wisdom under the sun, but there is wisdom above the sun that cries out to be answered. And you can answer it not only in your own life for Christ, but also in the lives of lost men and women that you know and love as well. So bring that sorrow and grief to the table. Let others know about Christ and the wisdom that is above the heavens as well. Let us now then come to that place where we find provision wisely put before us. in simple